agencies are trained and are not trained in immigration law. Local police are usually trained only in criminal law, which remains fairly constant. Immigration law, however, is not criminal but civil law, and is constantly changing. INS agents are especially trained in the enforcement of immigration laws. Number three, local governments have to expend money out of their own coffers in defending these types of cases. They are also quite time-consuming. In most cases, local governments' insurance does not cover civil rights violations, and therefore additional legal counsel must be retained. This is costly to local governments, not to mention increasing the court's caseloads. High-priority criminal law enforcement and investigation is being subdued for the purpose of enforcing low-priority non-criminal matters. This does not set well with the local taxpayers, especially the Hispanic taxpayers, when local law enforcement agencies are trying to justify their budgets. The purpose of the bill is to resolve the problem of local law enforcement agencies enforcing federal immigration laws. The bill is a restatement of what the law is and will give a Oregon statute citation of what the law is. Hopefully this bill will better educate the local law enforcement agencies as to what the law is. We can offer any assistance in this bill in any other matter affecting Hispanics. We would be happy to do so. And as far as legislative background, ironically, this bill did pass the House last session by a 40-11 vote. It also passed the Senate chamber by a 17-11 vote. But due to the House rules regarding the House bills, they were passed under different House bills and therefore technically did not have the proper passage.
And that was in 1983.
That's correct.
Ms. Paulson, did you want to?
I was asked to find some examples of instances where people have been afraid because of this law. We see people who are not reporting crime for fear of being reported by INS. For example, a client purchased a car, who loaned it to someone who stole it. He wouldn't report the car theft because he was afraid that law enforcement officials would turn him into immigration. Another example, someone stole someone's driver's license, and the person that stole it was running around getting tickets. And this person came in and asked us for advice, and we of course advised them to contact the Motor Vehicles Fraud Division and let them go after this person, and we were afraid of being reported to immigration, so they wouldn't report the misuse of driver's license. So I think that we've got those are just two examples that we've gone to a phone call to the insurance that handle the cases that I found. Also, I think it's a concern because very few of us carry around identification in our pockets that we could prove that we're U.S. citizens with. I know I couldn't, driver's licenses, even though they have places to live, aren't sufficient to do the job. And I think that if you are brown skinned or Spanish speaking, you're going to have problems in terms of being questioned and detained, and these things are very serious issues.
Are there questions from the committee? Or Mr. Santa?
Yes, I'd like to follow up with a couple more comments too. And in the package we provided you in our written testimony, I think it's important to point out that legal counsel from the 1983 session, legal counsel for INS was in fact contacted and they saw no difficulty with the bill. One other additional aspect that's starting to play a greater and greater role and more concern to the Hispanic community is that drunk driving concerns in the state where you have roadblocks for that purpose. There is obviously, that is not a particular concern to us, but a concern to us is that if they do not fall into the drunk driving suspicion, we are likely to have a availability of a case popping up where law enforcement officials may in fact ask these drivers to, if they're suspected of being illegal or not having documentation, then I think you may jeopardize the roadblock situation there.
I noticed in these minutes that there were some amendments to the bill last time. Is this bill that we have before us, the bill as amended last time.
That is my understanding.
Okay. Are there further questions? Any questions from the clerk? Thank you very much. Ms. Helmer? Now, you also wanted to comment on 2336.
I'm Violetta Helmer with the Women's Crisis Service in Salem and representing the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. We're a statewide agency of 31 domestic violence programs. That's hotline shelter programs for women who are victims of violence to contact. We owe statewide very few women who are victims of violence who are also undocumented. The primary reason we don't hear from women in this kind of situation is because they're afraid that we're going to turn them into the immigration. We, of course, don't ask people if they're citizens, you know, to make determination about whether or not they get into our shelter. But a lot of the services that women require do ask whether or not they're citizens of the United States, like welfare, food stamps, or say they needed hospitalization of some kind or another, or say they needed any number of other services. They wouldn't ask for them because they would be afraid that somebody would turn them into to immigration. So that presents some serious problems. In other words, we have folks running around who are getting beaten up pretty seriously, who are afraid to deal with us, who are supposed to be a safe place, because they're afraid that we'll turn them in, or that somebody that we're in contact with will turn them in. The second part of this is that very serious domestic violence occurs against women who are undocumented, and they're afraid to call the police for fear that when the police come out, the local police departments will come out and decide that these folks are undocumented, not deal with the violence, and maybe report them to INS or arrest them for something that, you know, is hardly the issue at that moment. So there are a lot of reasons why undocumented people are afraid to contact social services, afraid to take care of themselves, afraid to protect themselves and their children. And that brings up another issue, because a lot of the children are American citizens, U.S. citizens, and they deserve, you know, the full range of protection that anybody does. And they're not receiving it because of their fear of immigration. So that's an issue that I think needs to be addressed. Another one is, we've seen some fairly serious incidences where one that comes to mind is a woman was hung from a tree by her neck and beaten by her husband. The police were called by neighbors. The police came and saw what was going on and didn't intervene because, they were just undocumented. You know, they're illegal, so we won't deal with this. I'm sorry, but, you know, the fact that somebody is committing a civil crime by being an undocumented worker just, I don't think, exactly qualifies them for not receiving protection against criminal activities. So, that's my testimony.
Questions from the committee? Was that a recent?
It was in the last year. It was about 7 months ago, I think.
In Marion County?
This is not Marion County. This is in another county.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Let me ask you a question. It seems a shame that we have to pass a law to tell people what
they're allowed to get protection.
Yeah. And it seems also a shame that we have to pass a law to basically send a signal, I guess, to law enforcement agencies that they're not responsible for certain kind of jurisdiction. Do you think that the passage of this kind of bill will assist in sending signals to undocumented individuals, at least as far as the state is concerned, that they will have access to services, things like that? But is the fear, and I know maybe that's about as far as we can go with this from the state, but is there also still a fear inherent on part of these individuals that they're going to have problems anyway because somebody's going to switch to the INS or whoever?
Right. That's going to
so we're only getting part.
It'll take a little while, you know, for a couple of years
to
be.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much. It's very helpful. Are there any other people who would like to testify on House Bill 2337? I'll tell you the name, and we'll move to House Bill 2127. Okay.
Sullivan, State Administrator, and appearing on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department. House Bill 2127 was filed.
Mr. Chairman, are we on 2125 or 2127?
I thought I said 2127. You still want to be here?
Still want to be here.
Oh, okay.
This 2125 went through my mind. 2127 was filed on behalf of the Judicial Department and would amend Chapter 107 voted by statute to provide that petitioners and divorcees be required to provide a notice of health insurance coverage to dependent spouses. The existing law requires the clerk of the court to provide this notice, which is required in Chapter 743, and the notice itself is prepared by the insurance commissioner. There should have been a copy attached to my testimony. We will send it over to you if it's not attached. In many of our trial courts presently, we find that the most economical method of providing this notice is to give it to the petitioner at the time in which they file their case. It saves us some processing and postage expense, and the petitioner is in any event sending materials to the respondent immediately after they file their suit. We have found that to do it this way costs down on time and money. And we have not been aware of any problems in petitioners or respondents receiving required notice. This bill wouldn't in any way affect the obligation that this notice is provided. It would merely shift the responsibility to the petitioner. The responsibility for providing these forms to the petitioners stayed with the trial courts, and we would keep copies of the notice on file and provide them free of charge. We estimate that in the upcoming biennium, we'd save approximately $3,600 in postage. In many ways, this is sort of a housekeeping measure. We have found there's a better way to do it. The notice is being provided as required, and this simply cuts out the middleman, so to speak. And I'd be happy to try and answer any questions you might have.
Questions from the committee? Representative Berger?
Well, one of the difficulties that a lot of people express in being able to go into the, right now, as I understand, the clerk is responsible for notifying the individuals of group insurance. Continue. One of the problems that people have when they go to courts is that the clerks or the administrative staff in the courts often will simply hand form to somebody without any explanation as to how they fill out that form. They resist giving out that kind of information for fear of getting some kind of area which is a responsibility of the court. And my concern here is that someone goes in and is handed this form as part of the petition process in a divorce case and doesn't really understand how to fill it out or what the notification is. I'm really not too sure what's happening here, but that's a concern to me.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burton. The notice itself doesn't require the petitioner to fill in anything. It just requires the petitioner to give it to the responding party. I know that in my year and 3 months as state court administrator, I've had two complaints about two of our trial courts who did simply just dump this notice on somebody and not explain what needed to be done about it. The notice itself is drafted by the insurance commissioner and explains the options a dependent spouse has in terms of continuing health insurance coverage during the dissolution period. If this kind of a change were made, I would expect we would have an informational, I could guarantee you, we'd have some sort of informational attachment we give initially to attorneys or parties coming in to file petitions that would explain what they need to do with it, just to make sure that if they didn't pick up the law change, we could notify them of it in that manner.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, Bill, are there any other kinds of notices that have to be given out in the same situation? Is this the only one, and is it housekeeping just for this because it's the only one?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, we looked at that aspect and found that this is really the only notice that we are presently required to provide, or that any of the parties are presently required to provide at the time of the filing of the dissolution suit. The legal pleadings themselves, the papers, are served upon the responding party, but those would be in any event. So we didn't find any other notices that would seem to fit in this kind of a category.
Thank you.
Representative Bunn.
Two questions. The first, is there any statutory authority for the, if this bill passes, would there be statutory authority for a clerk to charge for one of these forms picked up by a petitioner or the petitioner's attorney? Second question, what would be the effect on a petition that was correct in all other respects but failed to have this document on it in terms of it being an effective petition?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Buck, on the first question, we have a general statute in Chapter 21 that authorizes us to charge for providing copies. And I suppose that could be applicable to this. I mean, it's not our intention to charge for these. If that was a concern, we could perhaps add some language to the bill.
Specifying that those are free.
Yeah, in perhaps in line 8, some words such as the petition may be obtained, the petitioner may obtain the form at the notice at the office of the clerk of the court or something to that effect. And I would not object to that kind of an amendment. As far as the second question, there would be no effect because the petition is filed. And after that point in time, right now the clerk has to notify the dependent spouse of the insurance coverage. This change would merely mean that after that petition is filed, the petitioner would have the responsibility of notifying, providing a copy of this notice to the dependent spouse. So it wouldn't affect the, in my understanding, it would not affect the suit in terms of its final.
Representative Patterson.
Could you just double check, Bill, and be sure that if the document were left off, you would still have effective service of the petition on the other party? Because I have some concern about
that. Representative, I'll be happy to do that.
Counsel?
And Mr. Linden, reading the bill, I have a policy question. You say that the burden would shift to the petitioner of dissolution. Now, are you assuming the petitioner is not the dependent spouse? I guess my question is, if the petitioner was the dependent spouse, why would the dependent spouse want to give notice to the other spouse who has the coverage that they have the right to continue insurance?
Mr. Chairman, Counsel, we could not think of a clean way to make sure we cover everybody in every case. You know, some cases the petitioner is the dependent spouse, other cases the petitioner is not. I think because of our understanding of the legislative intent when this provision was passed in 83, that they wanted to make sure everybody got covered, even if it was slightly inefficient in terms of the way we were doing it, that the inefficiency in the system was outweighed by their legislative intent that notice be provided in each and every case. So we will run into some of those cases where the petitioner is the dependent spouse.
Okay. Let's, for sake of argument, let's assume that most dependent spouses are women. And what percentage of the cases are women the petitioners?
Mr. Chairman, Counsel, I would like to see if we could determine that. We have to do a manual kind of a review of a month's worth of cases to find out the percentage. One other point, even if the petitioner is a dependent spouse, it's important that they receive that information about the health coverage, which we would give them when they file their petition. So whether or not it's important for the respondent who has the coverage to get it, they would still have that obligation to provide it, but they would be getting the information they need at that time as well.
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering, right now in the current system, how does the clerk determine if either one of the parties has continued health insurance, or is it simply a general question?
Counsel, we don't try and determine if there is coverage that would be applicable. We just simply provide them with this notice that they need to look into it.
So what you're envisioning now is everybody's going to be sending notice whether it applies or not under this new bill.
Counsel, right now everybody gets notice. It's just a question of who's going to provide, who's responsible for making sure that notice is passed along.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? Representative Peterson.
Yeah, okay. I guess Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still a little confused because I don't really know how the system now works. You're fairly convincing in that it will save time and money for, you know, your office, for the clerk, whoever. I guess the question I have on the other end is sort of philosophical. Will the petitioner and the people involved be as well off? And I don't know if you can answer that specifically, but I'm trying to get some sort of philosophical sense of the other side of the argument here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson. I think they will be as well off as they are under the present system. This provides, a pretty clear affirmative obligation on the part of the petitioner to pass the notice on to the respondent. If a petitioner were to neglect to do that, they would open themselves up to some liability, which the respondent could pursue. So the remedy is there in the case where the petitioner has not fulfilled this statutory obligation. So in that sense, I don't think we're taking any protection away from respondents who may be the dependent spouse.
If I may continue.
Sure.
It seems at this point it's almost automatic for government officials or clerks, whoever, to do this. It seems it will be far less automatic and known for a petitioner to do this. How is that information transferred?
Representative Peterson, what we would do is, as I mentioned just in passing a minute ago, was assuming this kind of a change were to be made, for a representative period of time after went into effect, when we hand out the notices that are required to be provided to the respondents, we'd have some sort of a little information sheet for the petitioner, you know, big letters. They would know this needs to be given to the respondent per, you know, House Bill 2127. I believe that we had, in Lane County at least when I was there, a similar information sheet when this provision went into effect in 83. So we would, I can guarantee the committee, we would have something that would flag it for the petitioners to know they needed to do something.
Further questions? Mr. London, I don't quite understand. Is this a separate mailing by the clerk to the parties? Is that how it's done currently?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it is.
And it's the only thing in, is it a, do most counties put this thing in an envelope or do they direct mail flyer? Does it vary?
Generally, we stuff the notice in an envelope, address it to the respondent that we would then have their address after the petition was filed, put it in the mail, and it goes first class.
And it goes to both parties?
We provide the petitioner with the notice at the time they filed their petition. The respondent, however, does receive a mailing. The current law requires us to furnish both parties with a copy of the notice. Typically, we give them to the petitioner because they're right there, or their attorney because they're right there in front of us, but we end up mailing to the respondent. Although, in some counties, the petitioners voluntarily take care of providing notice to the respondent.
Thank you. Are there any further questions? Thank you very much. You might want to kind of stay closed here. Ms. Marcia Oldenmiller, please. And could you identify yourself for the record?
Chair and members of the committee, I'm Marcia Oldenmiller representing the Women's Rights Coalition, and the Women's Rights Coalition represents some 40 organizations and many individuals from throughout Oregon who are concerned with issues affecting women. Continuing coverage under group health insurance policies is a statutorily created right in Oregon which protects dependent spouses, most of whom are women. We have some concerns about the effect of House Bill 2127 on that right. ORS 743.880 subsection 3 provides that the spouse of a certificate holder of group insurance may exercise the right to obtain coverage under an individual health insurance policy if coverage of the spouse under the group policy ends because that spouse is no longer a qualified family member. This right extends to a spouse seeking to continue coverage and any children that must and must be exercised within 31 days of the date the policy would terminate because the spouse is no longer a qualified family member. ORS 107.092 currently requires the clerk of the court to notify both parties that a dependent spouse has the right created by ORS 743.880. House Bill 2127 proposes to amend ORS 107.092 to place the burden to notify on the petitioner. Some of the points that I'm going to make have already been brought up by committee counsel and other members of the committee, but I want to reiterate our concerns in those respects. We're concerned that the proposed amendment seems to assume that the petitioner in a suit for dissolution will always be the party carrying the health coverage and who therefore must notify the responding party. Might there not be cases where the petitioner was not the party carrying the coverage? And in such a case where the petitioner, not the respondent, would be the party who needs notice of her or his right to continue coverage. And there may also be cases where the petitioner is totally unaware of the nature of the policy carried by the respondent as to the fact that it exists or whether it is group coverage. It seems to us that whatever system of notice the committee elects to adopt should include notice to both parties. Perhaps it would be feasible on the dissolution form to have a question to both parties, do you have group health insurance, and some reference to the rights of a dependent spouse to continue this coverage. We're also concerned that the notice should be given, continue to be given, period. Placing the burden on the petitioner, even if the court clerk maintains forms for this purpose, might jeopardize the certainty that the respondent will be notified. And one last point is that in cases where the dependent spouse must act within 31 days to continue the coverage, a timely and accurate system of notice is especially crucial to avoid the loss of benefits altogether. Thank you. Any questions?
Question. Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Let's see. You would prefer not to have the bill. Is that what your bottom line is? Unless it gets worked out.
We would prefer to whatever the system be, that it give accurate and timely notice to both parties. And I think if you presume that notice, that the petitioner sends the respondent that notice, the petitioner may not even know if the respondent has benefits that would cover them. So even while they themselves are notifying the other party, they might be the one that actually needs the protection of that notice. And I don't even know if the current statute covers that, but that is an issue that comes to mind as I read this bill. So.
Well, at least the statute says that both parties should be notified currently.
Right.
Yeah.
As it stands now.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there any other individuals here that would like to comment on House Bill 2127? If not, we'll close the hearing on that. Now, I think House Bill 2096 is going to take us a little time. Is that no?
No.
I was just trying to debate whether to have a little break right now or keep going.
I have a meeting in the Speaker's office, and I don't know how long it'll be.
Okay, why don't we take a 10-minute break?
Great American.
Great.
There you go.
Hearing will come to order, please.
I might be on stage.
We'll have a hearing on House Bill 2096. Ms. Abrams and Mr. Linden.
Commission on the Judicial Branch. House Bill 2096 is another of the Commission's bills which results from the Commission's continuing review of the unified court system after the state takeover. The purpose of the bill is to, it does several things. Correct certain inaccuracies and ambiguities in existing law relating to the creation of liens, and it specifically resolves some problems created by certain legislation enacted during the 1983 session. I'd like to give a little bit of background on this bill and what happened in 1983, which will help, I think, explain how some of the problems that 2096 are intended to resolve developed. Near the end of the 1983 session, the legislature passed a bill which established a county clerk lien record. This record was to be maintained by county clerks and would serve as a public depository of certain documents creating liens on real and personal property located within the county. And the county clerk lien record was to contain certain administrative warrants and orders issued by state and local agencies that had the power to assess taxes and civil penalties, such as the Department.